From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of America's premier folklorists. Alan Lomax's early recordings documented the music of Leadbelly, Woody Guthrie, and Jelly Roll Morton. Also today, Mike Myers of Saturday Night Live tells us how he created his ongoing sketches Wayne's World and Sprockets. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays some popular songs and their lesser-known verses. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of The Simpsons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Thousands of federal workers could find themselves on furlough tomorrow if Senate leaders can't come up with a deficit reduction package that the president will agree with. The Senate's working for passage of a plan that was approved by the House in the early hours of this morning. The measure still aims for $500 billion in savings over 5 years, but it's much vaguer about specific spending cuts and tax increases than the version rejected by the House last week. President Bush hasn't said yet whether or not he'll agree to the measure. Much of the Arab world today condemned Israel for the killing of at least 19 Palestinians during a riot at the site of a mosque in Old Jerusalem. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
The Jordanian parliament called a special session Monday to address the killings in the Old City. Demonstrations, which could turn violent, are expected throughout Jordan tomorrow. The Jordanian government condemned the killings as racist and criminal. The PLO in Tunisia called on the UN to oust Israel from the West Bank, and Secretary General Peres de Cuellar said it appeared that Israeli authorities had used excessive force. The violence, he said, tragically illustrates the stalemate in Arab-Israeli relations. Arab leaders said the Palestinian conflict was the root cause of the Gulf crisis and warned of more violence ahead. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
U.S., British, and Australian warships forced an Iraqi vessel into port today after it was found to be carrying rice, flour, and other cargo in violation of the United Nations embargo. The Iraqi registered ship was on its way to Iraq's southern port of Basra when it was intercepted. A U.S. military statement said the ship was searched by a multinational boarding crew, then taken to an unidentified port. Earlier in the day, the three warships fired warning shots to force another Iraqi vessel to stop. It was found to contain no cargo in violation of the blockade and was allowed to proceed. It was the deadliest day in the Gulf for Operation Desert Shield. Two U.S. pilots were killed in a jet crash, and eight helicopter crewmen are missing. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
The jet that crashed, killing two U.S. pilots, is part of the Alabama Air National Guard. The Phantom reconnaissance jet was on a routine mission. A Navy spokesman said tonight that debris from the two Huey helicopters was found after a search in the waters of the Gulf of Oman. The two helicopters and an eight-man crew vanished from the radar screens at dawn today. The search continues for those aboard. There have been eight helicopter crashes since Operation Desert Shield began. All of them remain under investigation. The powdery sand here has been a challenge to maintenance crews, who say that spare parts are the key to keeping the helicopter fleet effective. In Dahran, Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices on Wall Street were up today in light holiday trading. The Dow Industrials gained 13 points to close at 2,523. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
The Woody Guthrie Library of Congress recordings preserve the songs and stories of one of America's most influential folk singers. The recordings were made by my guest, Alan Lomax. Lomax has devoted his life to the study of folk culture in America and around the world. His father, John Lomax, was one of the first popularizers of American folk songs. The father and son were the first folklorists to travel around the American South, recording songs on portable record machines. They both contributed thousands of field recordings to the Library of Congress's Archive of American Folk Song, which John Lomax founded in 1941. Alan Lomax went on to develop a system for measuring cultural differences in music and dance from around the world. For many years, he's directed a research project on the subject at Columbia University. When Alan Lomax and his father John first went on the road together to record musicians, they used one of the first portable recording machines.
The first machine that my father and I took out was a Thomas Edison cylinder machine. And then the Library of Congress kindly replaced that with a disc machine that embossed the groove on an aluminum disc. But for a long time, I was a media bug because I saw that the job of the folklorist was to make a bridge between people who had no voice and the big world of communication. And that's what I did for the first, half of my life, was simply run with a recording machine and record. In here, in the West Indies, in Italy, in Spain, in Great Britain, and to encourage other people to do it and to publish the results, because this was the way that people could learn that other folks were out there just as interesting as they were. That's the first big lesson of the recording machine.
When you first started recording, you were a teenager and you were on the road with your father. What were your responsibilities in those very early days?
Well, basically, I ran the machine and lifted it and carried it. The whole thing weighed about 500 pounds, and I broke it down and put it in the back of our Ford, Model A Ford, often two or three times a day. It kept the fat off of me.
Were you interested in this, or were you just doing this to please your father when you were a teenager?
Well, no. I mean, I was an anthropologist in college and a radical. And I wanted to go along to see what was happening in the South. I'd been a Southern kid, and I knew that what my middle class surround said, which was that blacks were perfectly content with their lot, was a lot of hooey. But I couldn't prove it because you couldn't get any information on the subject. There was nobody who was talking out of school. It was too dangerous. And so I went out to see what I could find out in the background of the recording sessions. And gradually, I began to learn how to get to know blacks, even though it was dangerous for them and, to some extent, for me.
Your father had been fired from his position at the University of Texas for recording cowboy songs, which were considered very dirty at the time. What was the reputation of folk music then? Did people not really understand what it was about? I mean, so much so that your father would be fired for... for taking it down?
Well, I think that is part of the same old story that's happening with our Southern North Carolina senator and the NEA. After all, the Puritan West Europeans really haven't ever had very much use for art or for recreation or for fun. So the arts have always been something extra. And they had to mind their place. They had to conform to the rules of society. So The big threat, of course, was that the subject of SEX would be mentioned. Remember, America in the 19th century was the most hung-up part of the whole world, or maybe ever had been, on the question of sex. Women were just untouchable. So anyway, my father was kicked out of the university for collecting cowboy songs on the grounds that some of them were dirty. They weren't, not in his book. And then later on at the Library of Congress, when I was running the folk song archive there, the archive was shut down by a rabid born-again Southern who attacked it because we had recorded that rantankerous, rambling ballad maker, Woody Guthrie. He just then, by the way, composed This Land Is Your Land, and I just recorded it for the Library of Congress. But they were so severe about it that they cut the whole Library of Congress appropriation out. Later it was put back, but the archive didn't recover for many years. And I think that's just the kind of thing that's happened recently.
Folklorist Alan Lomax is my guest. Let me get back to the days when you were on the road traveling through the South recording songs. You and your father were, I think, the first people to actually record in prison camps in the South. Why did you want to go there to record songs?
Well, there's always been an anomaly in the black community. All secular songs, and this follows out my Calvinist hypothesis, were considered sinful. Anything that wasn't religious was sinful. So that the whole of the secular, great secular song art of the black, the blues, the hollers, the work songs, all the casual songs of amusement were forbidden. You could be church. You could be kicked out of the church for singing them if you were a black person in a black, respectable black community. So that the, it was very difficult for us to get at this rich and unknown treasure trove of American music and lyricism without in the black, normal black community. People were scared to sing them, scared of criticism. So we decided to go where the devils were. I mean, the people who were beyond redemption. And we found them in the prisons, and we recorded a whole literature, which is still virtually unknown. Song bag of beautiful tunes, new kinds of melodies, and all sorts of things we found in the prison camps of the South. But the blacks were overjoyed to have a chance to do something, to let their problems be known, and because they had put tremendous a lot of their feelings and sorrows into these songs. They expressed their the terrors of their existence. You could say those prison camps were very much equivalent to the concentration camps in Hitler's Germany. They threatened any black who stepped out of line, who looked impudent, who talked back. He might easily end up there, down the chain of lawlessness that then controlled the South.
I think the best known of the recordings that you made of prisoners was your recordings with Leadbelly, and you continued to record him after he got out.
Yeah, we did the first singer biography of him.
Let me play one of the recordings you made by Leadbelly, and this is Midnight Special. Would you like to say a few words about the circumstances under which you recorded it or the song itself? And you might want to tell us, too, how you met Leadbelly.
Well, Leadbelly had been in the Texas pen a couple of times, but we found him in the Louisiana penitentiary, where prisoners were not allowed to sing in the fields, but they could have their own entertainers. And Leadbelly was a camp entertainer. He had his guitar there. And we went to camp number one, and when he heard we were there, he ran 100 yards from his cell to where we were, arrived without even breathing hard, and sat down and sang Irene Goodnight. Was the first song he sang us, and he sang a song to appeal to the governor of Louisiana to let him out of there, because woman was mourning for him. And then he sang, among other things, the great Midnight Special, which is actually the song of the main theme song of the Texas Penitentiary, Let the Midnight Special Shine Its Ever-Loving Light on You. Think of prisoners who don't know whether they'll live through the next day, who are working from dawn in the morning till dark at night, who, if they fall afoul of a guard, may be beaten to death, hanging on the bars, absolutely stone-weary, wiped out, and watching the headlight of some onrushing train flash across the walls of their prison and into their faces. That's the mood of the song.
About an A-bar and the dress she wore, umbrella on the shoulder, see the paper in her hand. Well, I'm going in at the governor, he's trying to lose her mom, and let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine a heaven-loving light on me. When I get up in the morning, when that big bell rings, over marching to the table, need the same old thing, not the talker on the table. There's nothing in my pants. Never said a thing about it. Have trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine your light on me. Let the midnight special shine every loving light on me.
That's Leadbelly, and that was recorded by you and your father?
Well, I don't know. I've recorded it so many times with him, I don't know.
I see, okay,
which
right.
Recording was which.
Did Leadbelly write Midnight Special?
No. He recomposed it. All black singers always, you know, remake it. Remake the song they sing. So they say, I'm the composer. Composed by whoever it was, even if they sing a song that's well known from some other source.
When Leadbelly was released from prison, he traveled with your father for a couple of years, and your father put on a lot of concerts for him. Do you have any memories of what it was like for Leadbelly going from the South to the North and suddenly, like, performing for folklorists, for intellectuals, performing at Harvard University? Was there a period of culture shock and serious adaptation for him?
Not at all. He was just in triumph. He, in his mind, and it was true, he was the best in the world. He was the king of the 12-string guitar players in the world. He had a voice you could hear for a mile, an absolutely beautiful silvery tenor voice. It's never been heard, by the way. It's only on our first recordings. It began to go as he lived in the city.
When you were recording musicians, did you ever take co-composer credit for one of their songs? I know that was often the case with people.
No. That came very much later. What happened was that we gave out our songs from the Library of Congress in our books for everybody to use. And then along came a lot of new people in the field who simply copyrighted them completely. Lonnie Donegan in England copyrighted all of Leadbelly's songs. And in order to protect the material, the only way that the publishing industry saw that I could do it was for me to co-claim them with some of the singers. And I did that. And that made it possible for the singers and their families to get royalties and for money to be to come into my hands so I could continue to do research. That's how it happened.
Why did you have to co-claim them instead of giving them the full credit?
Well, arrangements and rearrangements of the text and so on. And that actually happened. You know, when we printed the books, we actually reworked songs to make them easy to appear in print. See, there was a choice. We had many versions of John Henry or Get Along Little Doggies or what. Were we going to print each of those versions, or were we going to print a composite version? We generally printed a composite version. And that's the way that the songs were popularized, in the composite versions.
So you felt like the editor of the songs?
Yeah, we edited them. And that's made it possible to actually administrate this material for the singers.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is folklorist Alan Lomax. This is Fresh Air. Folklorist Alan Lomax is my guest. I want to ask you about, I think, what's considered to be among the most important recordings you've ever made, and I'm thinking of the recordings you made with Jelly Roll Morton, the Library of Congress recordings, which features both him singing and playing, as well as talking about his life. How did you get to make those recordings with him?
Well, as I used a recording machine in the field, I began to discover that what an artist would say about the song at the end of a performance was usually psychologically and emotionally very revealing. And I began to record more and more of these codas to songs. And gradually, the codas began to stretch out longer and longer until I was recording whole life histories. And I had done a number of these by the time Jelly Roll came to the Library of Congress, anxious to prove to the world that jazz was not from Memphis, as Handy had said it was in a Billboard interview, but was from New Orleans. And Jelly Roll, an extraordinary intellectual he was, had the whole story worked out when he came to me in my office, which was backstage of the Coolidge Auditorium, the Library of Congress. On the stage was a grand piano. Around the hall, there were the busts of Bach and Beethoven. Jelly Roll sat down at the piano, completely at home with his peers, because he was, after all, our first literate native composer, and began to tell the story of jazz. Naturally, I was no great friend of jazz at the time, because jazz was what was driving folk music into obscurity, in my view. But this man was so fascinating that I thought I would try to find out how much, well, folklore there was in him. And within an hour, he'd said such wonderful things that I raced upstairs, got permission to work with him for a week and to use any number of discs to take down his life. That's how it all happened.
Let me play a short excerpt of the oral history that you recorded. Jelly Roll Morton is talking about when he started to play in the Tenderloin District in New Orleans.
In my younger days, I was brought in to the Tenderloin District by friends, young friends, of course. Even before we were in long pants, we used to steal long pants from around the fathers and brothers and uncles and so forth and so on.
Could you go down there before we had long pants on?
No, why, the policeman would run you right in jail. It'd run you ragged. Of course, we kids from time to time would climb those 8 and 10 feet high board fences. We'd really climb them and get away from these people, but they kept us right out of the district. They'd take the straps on the end of the clubs and just make switches out of them, cut our legs into ribbons, and was very frightened of, very much frightened. I happened to invade that section, one of the sections of the district where the birth of jazz originated.
Where was that? And how old were you?
At that time, that was the year of 1902. I was about 17 years old. I happened to go to Villeray and Bienville. At that time, one of the most famous night spots after everything was closed. It was only a back room where all the greatest pianists frequented after they got off from work. All the pianists got off from work in the sporting houses at around 4 or after, unless they had plenty of money involved. And they would go to this Frenchman's. That was the name of the place, Saloon. And there would be everything in the line of hilarity there. They would have even millionaires to come to listen to the different great pianists, what would no doubt be their favorites maybe among them.
Jelly Roll Morton, recorded by my guest Alan Lomax back in 1938. How did you meet Woody Guthrie? I want to play one of the records that that you made with him. How did you first meet him?
Well, at the time I was doing a series of radio programs for CBS called Back Where I Come From in the evening, and then we had a morning series about the wellsprings of music. It was the first time that folk music was on a coast-to-coast radio network in the country, and I was looking for people for that show. I was the master of ceremonies at a benefit Congress, at a benefit evening for Loyalist Spain, and Woody was on the program. And he just got in from California, and this little dusty-headed man stood up there. He told stories more than he talked at that time. He could hold an audience just like Will Rogers, and sang So Long It's Been Good to Know You and his other songs. And he went home with me that weekend to Washington and spent a week at my house. And we cooked up the program that I put on CBS with him at the time.
Woody Guthrie collected songs, but in a different way than you did. He, you know, traveled around the country and picked up songs wherever he went. Did he understand your motivation in collecting songs?
Oh, we were, I wouldn't say we were exactly members of the same family intellectually, but we were pretty close. We used to have singing contests, Woody and I. And at the time, since I had studied all the folk songs in the country in every area, I could out-sing him. And he liked that. We had so many songs, we'd only sing the first line of each one. And then the other person would have to take the challenge of what of that and carry the contest on. Now, Woody knew what I was doing. He liked it. He knew that my job was to try to get people like him a hearing. When RCA Victor came and asked me to make an album, I said, hell, I shouldn't make the album. It should be this guy, Woody Guthrie. And they did it, and that was the Dust Bowl Ballads on Victor. No, my job was to push forward these great people that I found instead of seeing myself.
Well, let's hear some of So Long It's Been Good to Know You, and this has just been reissued by Rounder Records. Your Library of Congress recordings have been brought out on Rounder. And we'll hear the end of So Long It's Been Good to Know You and then a little bit of Woody Guthrie talking about why he wrote the song.
The church houses were jammed and packed. People was sitting from front to the back. It was so dusty, the preacher couldn't read his text. So he folded his specs and he took up collections. Said, so long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust isn't rolling me home. Gotta be drifting along.
Well, what did you people do then? What happened to your folks, your relatives and neighbors and acquaintances and people like you all through that country from Panhandle to Nebraska?
Well, Alan, they didn't know what to do. They sat around and talked there for weeks and weeks. Hated to give up what they'd worked there for 50 years and been born and raised on and had their kids on, and their kids had been born and raised and married on and had their kids on this land. They didn't know just exactly what to do, but they couldn't pay their debts. They owed the bankers $3,500, $4,000 on a combined harvester, $1,100 on a tractor. They owed them a year's fuel bill, which always amounted to several hundred dollars. They owed a grocery bill for about a year. They owed all kinds of bills, seed bills and everything else. When they couldn't pay them, well, naturally, they come down with a mortgage and took their land. These people didn't have but one thing to do, and that was just to get out in the middle of the road. Incidentally, the 66 highway runs just about a mile.
Woody Guthrie is featured on the Library of Congress recordings made by my guest folklorist Alan Lomax. How do you think your role as folklorist has changed over the years? Or perhaps I should ask, how do you think the role of the folklorist has changed?
Well, so far as I'm concerned, I'm still doing the thing that I was inspired to do in our early recording sessions, when people would look at the microphone and say, Mr. President, I want you to come down here and help us people where we are in our hard times in this place. And they looked at my father and myself as a channel to tell their troubles and to let their lives be known. That's what I've essentially tried to do all my life.
Folklorist Alan Lomax. He recently hosted and produced the public TV series American Patchwork on regional American culture. Lomax's recordings of Big Bill Brunsey, Sonny Boy Williamson, and Memphis Slim have been reissued on the CD Blues in the Mississippi Night. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
You got me crying.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the obnoxious host of Wayne's World and the pretentious host of Sprockets. He's Michael Myers of Saturday Night Live. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays some forgotten verses from popular songs. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us if the second season of The Simpsons will be as funny as the first. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Debate is continuing on a new budget resolution in hopes of averting a total shutdown of the U.S. government. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Capitol Hill.
The House passed the budget resolution early this morning, along with a stopgap funding measure that would allow the government to continue to operate until October 20th. The budget resolution now before the Senate would retain the overall targets for deficit reduction that the original budget plan designed. That plan was defeated in the House on Friday. The new proposal eliminates the most onerous aspects of the original agreement. Medicare would not be cut as deeply, for instance. It leaves many other contentious issues, like tax hikes, blank for the appropriate congressional committees to fill in. The vote in the House on the budget resolution this morning was along partisan lines, and in the Senate, it's expected that if the plan passes, it will pass the same way, with mostly Democratic support. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
David Souter, one day away from becoming this nation's 105th Supreme Court Justice, swore today to uphold the U.S. Constitution and pass it on to future generations in good shape.
I will try to preserve it. I will try to transmit it, I hope refreshed, to another generation of the American Republic, which is the inheritance of us all.
Souter made his brief comments to those gathered for the White House ceremony, including President Bush. Today's oath is the one administered to all government workers. Tomorrow, the 51-year-old Souter must take another oath at the Supreme Court before he can officially assume his position on the nation's highest bench. Two U.S. pilots died today when their reconnaissance plane crashed in Saudi Arabia. The pilots from the Alabama Air National Guard were killed when their plane crashed during a training flight. The cause of the crash is unknown. Also today, Navy search teams discovered the wreckage of two helicopters lost overnight during a training mission in the Northern Arabian Sea. So far, no survivors have been found. There were 8 crew members on board the two helicopters. Iran's president was quoted today as saying he's honoring United Nations sanctions against Iraq despite improved relations between the two former enemies. In an interview published in a French newspaper, President Hashemi Rafsanjani said Tehran is observing the embargo. He also blamed Iraq for the presence of foreign troops in the region. Rafsanjani, however, ruled out sending troops to Saudi Arabia, saying his nation has enough problems guarding its 750-mile border with Iraq. The South African government has announced a judicial probe into the deaths of 11 blacks allegedly killed when soldiers fired on a crowd last month. The announcement was made today by the country's justice minister. Witnesses said at the time of the incident that soldiers opened fire on the crowd without warning, but police claim soldiers returned fire when they came under attack by a crowd. On Wall Street today, prices closed higher, with the Dow Industrials gaining just over 13 points to close at 2523.76. Advances led declines. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air.
There is no verse to this song, 'cause I don't want to wait a moment too long to say that I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China.
The long-forgotten Harry Babbitt isn't the only singer who doesn't want to make time for verses. Verses are those sort of half-sung, almost spoken introductions to classic pop songs, usually songs that come from the musical theater. Most singers would just rather go straight to a song's catchy chorus and forget the slow build-up. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead samples a few verses to well-known tunes and a few singers who remember them.
Singers who skip introductory verses to songs remind me a little of folks who say they read Moby Dick but skip the boring parts. They don't understand how much a verse helps shape a tune's overall rhythm. As jazz critic Francis Davis has observed, verses also add suspense to familiar songs, delaying the gratification that comes when you recognize the melody. For example, here's Weslow Whitfield from her new album on the Landmark label, singing the verse to a standard by Rodgers and Hart.
Look at yourself If you had a sense of humor, you would laugh to beat the band. Look at yourself. Do you still believe the rumor that romance is simply grand? Since you took it right on the chin, you have lost that bright toothpaste grin. My mental state is all a jumble. I sit alone and sadly mumble. Fools rush in, so here I am, very glad to be unhappy.
Only the talky rhythms of a verse could accommodate an expression like toothpaste grin into a lyric. Wesla Whitfield is less a jazz singer than a cabaret singer, and those artists include verses more often than jazz folk do. Some lyrics are put together so that a song won't really work without the verse. This next tune by Harold Arlen, with words by Ira Gershwin and Yip Harburg, is structured so that the verse is the build-up to a joke. The title of the song is the punchline. The singer is Ella Fitzgerald.
I never traveled further north than old Van Cortlandt Park, and never further south than the aquarium. I've seen the charm of Jersey City, but first let me remark, I saw it from the Empire State Solarium. But we've been putting nickels in the postal savings bank, and when those nickels pile up, we can toddle off and swank. And I don't mean an ordinary cook's tour, I mean a Coven Deluxe tour. Someday we'll go places, new lands and new faces, the day we quit punching the clock. The future looks pleasant, but at present, let's take a walk around the block.
Sometimes you get so used to hearing a song without the verse, you don't realize that it has one. This next Gershwin tune was made famous by Fred Astaire, who sang quite a few verses in his time. But as far as I know, he never recorded the one to this number. But as Dinah Washington shows on her 1954 recording, the verse actually makes up more than half the song.
I was a stranger in the city, out of town were the people I knew. I had that feeling of self-pity. What to do? What to do? What to do? The outlook was decidedly blue. And as I walked through the dreary streets alone, it turned out to be the luckiest day I've known. Foggy day in London town had me low and it had me down. I view the morning with much alarm. British Museum had lost its charm. How long I wondered could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. For suddenly I saw you standing there, and in foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere.
Jazz instrumentalists virtually never play verses, and after hearing a few in a row, you've probably figured out why. They rarely amount to much melodically. That's part of why singers skip them, too. But every once in a great while, someone will record a verse and skip the rest of the song. Sinatra did that with Stardust. My favorite example comes from that great 60s pop group, the Bonzo Dog Band.
The loveliness of Paris. Seems somehow sadly gay.
Thank you very much. You're really wonderful. I'm very lucky for us this time.
The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going back to my city by the bay.
Of course, that's I Left My Heart in San Francisco. By perversely throwing the meat of the song away, the Bonzos make the point that verses are self-sacrificing. They just exist to make you want to hear what follows. Which means the reason most singers skip verses is exactly why we should hear them more often.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence.
The fact is, the only work that really brings enjoyment is the kind that is for girl and boy men. Fall in love, you won't regret it. That's the best work of all if you can get it. Holding hands at midnight, 'neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
This is Fresh Air. When Mike Myers joined the cast of Saturday Night Live last year, he was not only the youngest member of the group, he seemed to be the best thing that had happened to the show in a long time. Myers created the character Dieter, the pretentious host of Sprockets, a postmodern culture show on West German television. One of Myers' most popular sketches is Wayne's World, a cable access TV show hosted by a loud, obnoxious teenager played by Myers. Wayne first started emerging as a character when Myers was working with the Second City Theater Company in Toronto. But the character is based on teenagers Myers remembers from high school.
Well, Wayne is a compilation or a distillation of everybody I knew growing up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a sort of adolescent, suburban, heavy metal experience. And so I thought, what if my character Wayne, who I did at Second City in Toronto and Second City in Chicago, had his own cable access show? Hopefully it would be how I was when I was a kid, which is, God, it would be great to have my own show in my basement, and then I'd have anybody I wanted on to be on. And it's completely, it makes no attempts to be universal. It's just totally about his basement and his world.
All right, welcome to Wayne's World. Here's your host, Wayne Campbell.
Party! Woo! Party hardy! Party! Woo! It's Friday, it's 10:30, it's time to party. I'm your excellent host, Wayne Campbell. With me, as always, is Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, before we bring out our first guest, we'd like to introduce our newest feature. It's called Movie World with Wayne and Garth.
Movie World! Movie World! With Wayne and Garth! Party
on! All right, let's take a look at the movies, all right? The first movie is Back to the Future 2, starring Michael J. Fox. I liked it, Garth.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Okay, let's move on.
Did you ever talk in the kind of teen slang that Wayne is always coming
up
with?
Yeah, I did. I went through a lot of adolescent phases. I went through a heavy metal phase, and then I went to England in 1977 just as punk was big. I went through a punk phase. Then I saw the movie Quadrophenia. Did you ever see that with
The
Who?
Yeah, yep.
And I went through a mod phase. There's a ton of mods in Toronto. And then I got hired at Second City. By that time, I just turned 19, so I was out of my adolescent thing. Although when I got hired at Second City, I had really short hair and a long tail down my back.
So do you keep your ears open for teenagers to hear what kind of language is? Because language changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does. But I'm surprised that it doesn't change all that much.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an adolescent accent, which is weird, that people tend to grow out of or socialized out of. And I was surprised at how homogenous to North America it is.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it was be like, I don't know what you mean. Hey, back off. Don't hassle me, man. It would be like that. I really like that guy, you know? And it's strange, too, because people who are in the arts had the same type of accent in Toronto, too. It's just, I really like that painting. I really thought it was great. I like his use of negative space. You want a cappuccino? I really like it there.
This is the roots of Dieter, right?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. They're all related. It's all... tribe? It's tribes, you know,
basically. I couldn't believe that there'd be any kind of link between Wayne and Dieter, but I guess you just
explained. Well, it was a friend of mine in Toronto who never actually got to be an artist, but did everything around art. Like, he was interested in photography, but he ended up painting backgrounds, you know, like the splotches of paint. And he was interested in being a filmmaker, but he got into colorizing and somehow managed to justify colorizing, even though it's sort of impolitic in the art world.
For our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, which features your character, Dieter, would you describe it for us?
Dieter was a young artist from Stuttgart who came to Toronto. He's an actual person.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, and he was a waiter in Toronto, and he would, like, take your order and say, what would you like? And then you would start to talk, and if it was a hot dog or something banal, he would say, your order has become tiresome. I'm going away now. And if his favorite tune came on, it would be like, yes, and would you like, hold on, my favorite song. And he would go up and dance. And then you'd wait for hours. But he was fascinated with obscure Americana, like F Troop and hockey cards. He loved hockey. That was our main thing that I thought I could talk to this person. Was he loved hockey, and I thought it was amazing. And he also loved to touch monkeys.
Oh.
And that's actually true, because he took a textures course in Stuttgart. And he had to touch tapioca, styrofoam, and monkeys. And it was that time that I knew that I loved to touch monkeys.
See, for our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, there's always a sequence in Sprockets where he says,
Would you like to touch my monkey?
Yeah, I could never figure out where that was from.
It's just because he took a textures course, and, you know, I love textures. Your eyebrows are bizarre. Can I touch them? You know, he'd say things like that.
Yeah, you have such a great way in that show of intellectualizing everything that's fun or pop or...
With Dieter.
With Dieter, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Any sort of pretentious or pseudo-pretentious idea I ever had, I can sort of stick it into Dieter, and Dieter can do it. And it's like, it's not me, it's this guy.
That was Vietnam by Schreibmaschine. And now's the time for Rater Record. What is your name?
My name is Gerhard Müller.
My name is Elsa Bauer.
And what gymnasia do you go to?
We go to the Goethe-Gymnasium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Your hair is grotesque. What did you think of the song on a scale of 1 to 14?
It was hellish yet exquisite. I give it a 9 out of 14.
I thought it was bourgeois and banal. I give it a negative 3 out of 14, and I thought lyrically it had...
Your story has become tiresome. Sadly, there are no integers on this scale, so your gangly adolescent attempt to be clever has been futile.
Well then, Dieter, what did you think of the song?
It had a good beat and it was easy to dance to. I gave it a 14. This next song is called Darwin's Burden by the Obelisks.
So this waiter, Dieter, mm-hmm. upon whom you model the character, does he know that this is an homage to him?
I don't think he does. And somebody told me he went back to Germany for a bit. His visa had expired. And then somebody told me he moved to Australia. Which makes total sense. So I'm sure it'll get back to him, but he's far too cool to ever call me and say, I understand you are doing me. You know, it would be just too not cool.
You did commercials as a kid?
Yeah.
What kinds of commercials?
I used to actually have my resume memorized. It was like Kit Kat, Applejack, Sunlight, BC Hydro, Datsun, Kmart Shoes, Wrigley Spearmint Gum. Just anything where they needed a little redheaded kid. You know, gee, Mom, this is the best. That was me. And then I went through my punk phase, and I couldn't get cast for my life because I had really short hair and T-shirts that said Anarchy in the UK, and they wanted, like, a little kid who plays basketball. And I'd be like, yeah, forget it. Basketball's bourgeois. So I stopped doing that.
But so how old were you when you stopped?
My last commercial, I was 17, and I haven't done one since.
Well, that's pretty old, actually.
Yeah.
I just expected you were doing it for baby food or something when you were really young.
No, I started when I was 8. I did a dancing commercial.
Oh, great.
For
with Datsun. Tap shoes and everything?
No, it was jazz dancing, which is even more a secret. Sort of dancing, solid gold type dancing that nobody really should see. And that's what I was doing.
Thus the corniest kind of dancing, the kind of interpretive dancing
no,
on
cornier.
Commercials. Yeah.
No, there's cornier dancing, and that's the reason I got into dancing was there was a show on Canadian TV called The Pig and Whistle, which was a mock pub show, British pub show for British expatriates who were like really homesick. And it was like, come in to the Pig and Whistle, come in and have a laugh. And then they had these Cockney, like Mary Poppins dancers, you know, with the kerchiefs tied around their neck and flat caps. And a lot of posing and a lot of knee slapping. Knees up, Mother Brown, knees up, Mother Brown. And I thought, now I was 4, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever, to dance like the guys in Mary Poppins. And so I said, can I do that? And my mom said, sure. So I went to the dance people, like the choreographers of that show, and they also had a dance school. And that's where I got into commercials.
Because, come a long way, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've come a long way since The Pig and Whistle.
So that's how you started doing commercials?
Yeah.
The name of the psychotic killer who escapes from the institution in Halloween is Michael Myers.
Yes.
Did you hear about this a lot when when
the
movie
came
out?
Whenever I go to cash a check, it's Michael Myers, the killer. Just don't kill me. Honestly, I'll cash the check. And I have to give them one of those, that's funny, I never get that laughs. That's great, I never get that. That's great. And, no, we're completely different. He's the evil Michael Myers. I'm the good Michael Myers. I mean, while it's true I do own a mask made out of flesh, I wear it infrequently, and I've really never killed anyone, to my knowledge. So I think that's where the similarities end.
Mike Myers, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mike Myers from the cast of Saturday Night Live. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. Today we have news of all of the bargaining around Washington, D.C., and attempts to come up with a new budget on Capitol Hill that would meet with the approval of the White House and that might lead President Bush to put the federal government back in operation tomorrow. It was shut down today, of course. Also, news from the Persian Gulf, where the U.S. has lost a jet reconnaissance plane and also 2 helicopters, and to talk with 2 military strategists about what the battle for Kuwait might actually be like if there is a war between the U.S.-led forces now in Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and a report on the uses of music and sound for healing.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Thursday, after months of reruns, the Fox Network is premiering a new episode of The Simpsons. TV critic David Bianculli has this first look at The Simpsons' second season.
This is it. When Fox moved The Simpsons from Sundays to Thursdays this summer, it was mounting a direct challenge to NBC's top-rated The Cosby Show, but with The Simpsons in reruns. Faithful fans had seen some of those shows 3 or 4 times already, and were looking for something new. The Simpsons fell out of the top 20, and the switch to Thursdays looked like a bad move. But this week is the true test, a new episode of The Simpsons. Now, there are 2 big questions here. 1, do viewers still care about The Simpsons? Based on how many people have been bugging me about when new shows will start, I'd say yes. The other question is The Simpsons as good as it was last year? Yes, it is. In fact, it's a riot. The second season premiere show has Bart facing a tough challenge. Either he passes the next history test, or he repeats the 4th grade.
Your grades have gotten steadily worse since the beginning of the term. Are you aware of that?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you aware that there is a major exam tomorrow on colonial America?
Yes, ma'am.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yes, ma'am.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yes, ma'am.
Bart, you haven't been paying attention to a word I said, have you?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, then what did I say?
straighten up and fly right?
Well, that was a lucky guess.
Bart's eventual solution is to make a deal with Martin, the smartest kid in class. If Martin tutors Bart in history, Bart will teach Martin how not to be such an outcast.
No.
No?
Only geeks sit in the front seat. From now on, you sit in the back row. And that's not just on the bus. It goes for school and church, too.
Why?
So no one can see what you're doing.
Oh, I think I understand. The potential for mischief varies inversely with one's proximity to the authority figure.
Oh, yeah, but don't say it like that.
That deal works for a while, but Bart is such a good teacher that the former A student decides it's more fun to hang out at the video arcade. That video arcade, by the way, contains a great game called Escape from Grandma's House, where the object is to keep Grandma from catching and kissing you. It's one of the many tiny details that makes Simpson watching so much fun. The smart kid doesn't just give a book report on Ernest Hemingway, he performs a one-man show, in costume. And when Bart dreams about history, he has Ben Franklin inventing a sled. On it is the slogan, "Don't sled on me." The jokes are great, and let's face it, the plots and scripts for The Simpsons make it the funniest and most honest sitcom on TV. The Simpsons may not dethrone Cosby, but it'll be a huge Thursday night success for Fox. And Fox will be thrilled by that, because Thursday is the best night to place advertising for weekend movies and on-air promos for Fox's weekend programming. Me, I'm just thrilled because The Simpsons is back, and better than ever.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Richard Parker, and Orjiva Blaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post reporter Blaine Harden discusses his years covering Africa. And artist William Wegman tells us about his long collaborations with his models, his pet dogs Man Ray and Fay Ray. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.